Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
When I was in a seventh grade math class, and we had this thing called number sense. So I wasn't on a track team, wasn't on the football team, wasn't on the basketball team. I was in the number sense club.
Nice.
Okay, we're talking real geeky, nerdy stuff here.
Michael Dell founded his company 33 years ago in his freshman dorm room at the University of Texas, Austin. He had $1,000 to buy PC parts and took orders for PCs over the phone. After that, it grew like crazy and made Dell Computer one of the fastest growing companies ever. The stock price went on a dizzying tear throughout the 1990s, roughly doubling most years throughout the decade. It made Michael Dell a multi-billionaire. Since then, the path hasn't been easy. The era of gonzo growth in personal computers and corporate servers, Dell's bread and butter, is over. Now attention has turned to smartphones and cloud computing. Sensing weakness, legendary investor Carl Icahn tried to buy out the company, which probably would have resulted in it breaking into pieces. Michael Dell fought him and won, taking his namesake company private and making it bigger than ever. Welcome to Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. I'm John Fort from CNBC. This is a weekly podcast bringing you the highest achievers from business, entertainment, philanthropy, and sport. We're going to learn how the very best climb to the top and pull out lessons along the way. If that sounds good to you, make this a habit. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app or on Google Play or anywhere fine podcasts are distributed. And once you've done that, tell a friend. I went to Round Rock, Texas to talk to Michael Dell just days before his big Dell World Conference in Las Vegas. We talked about the product news for CNBC viewers, but we also talked about his journey for Fort Knox, about almost losing a company he spent nearly two-thirds of his life building, and how he developed the skills he needed to become a legendary founder, CEO, and survivor. We started off talking about the battle 4 years ago for the future of Dell. Here's Michael Dell.
Did you ever think you might lose the company?
Yes. I didn't think it was a high likelihood, but there were definitely some difficult and awkward moments.
How did you deal with that possibility? Who did you talk to?
Well, I spent a lot of time with some incredibly skilled lawyers, they were very helpful. Spent a lot of time talking to my wife. You know, my wife has been my best friend, my counselor, my partner, for 27 years. And so that's been an important pillar for me in getting through challenges like this. We had a great team, and you just kind of power through it one day at a time. And, we made our way through it. But, if I looked at the headlines and some of the incendiary things that were said, during that period, there was a lot of nonsense out there. And, I don't think you ever did this, John, but I think there was some media that sort of reverberated on itself. And, they were creating news where there was no news. And, that's obviously a bad thing to be doing.
Did you always know what Dell, the company, I mean, it's your name, what it meant to you? Or did the experience of possibly losing it drive that home in a different way?
I always knew what it meant to me and was determined to see it through and see it to the success that we had imagined. And it's been all that and more.
So you were 19, 33 roughly years ago, in your dorm room, freshman in Austin, coming up with Dell, building PCs. What do you think today's Michael Dell in a dorm room somewhere is building? It's probably not a PC.
Yeah, might be a little late for that, but I think, look, we're in an incredibly exciting time in terms of artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning, unsupervised learning, the fifth generation cellular network, the digital transformation, the Internet of Things, all the security challenges. You've got sort of this Cambrian explosion of opportunity that is tremendous. And if you think the last 30 years have been exciting in technology, I think the next 30 years will, you know, make it look like child's play.
So would you place a bet? Would it be AI? Is that what the next Michael Dell is hacking on today?
Yeah, I think you have to do stuff that you're actually incredibly passionate and excited about, and you know something about, right? Mm. I don't, you know, the opportuneurs don't do as well as the entrepreneurs. And so I think you have to really believe in what you're doing.
So it's less about, hey, I think this is going to be hot, so I'm going to go do it, and more about, this is what I'm really passionate about, and I'm just going to push on that and see where it takes me.
I believe it. It excites me. It interests me, and I've got an idea, right?
So we were just talking about 19-year-old Michael Dell and imagining what he might be doing today, but actually thinking back, what were some of the mistakes, pitfalls that you made early on, where if you had the DeLorean and you were going back and talking to yourself, you'd be like, I mean, it all worked out fine. So I'm sure you don't want to like create a wormhole and change history or anything. But what are some of the things that you would say? Hey, watch out for that, or don't care so much about that.
Yeah, we made a lot of mistakes, and fortunately, none of them were so big that we couldn't be sitting here today.
Right.
We learned a lot by trial and error. You know, started the company with $1,000. A week before I was taking my final exams as a freshman. Well, maybe that wasn't such a good idea, but you know, when you're 19 years old, you haven't developed all the skills you need in terms of judgment and rational thinking. You know, we made mistakes around inventory management and supply demand and trying to create new generations of products and designing in things. And you know, we learned from that the importance of inventory management, and we kind of went from a bad mistake that caused us to stumble to having an extraordinary capability that was a wellspring of growth and success for a long, long time. Hmm. And so, you know, look, I think
That's the growth of just-in-time manufacturing, which was the original Dell magic, was from screwing up the management of your inventory.
That's right. And you know, when you're doing new things that have never been done before, you kind of have to feel your way through it and make mistakes. And the faster you can make the mistakes and correct, not make the same mistake over and over again, well, your learning cycle, continuous improvement, is only going to be accelerated.
Where do you think a kid gets that mindset that allows not failure and depression, but failure and learning and moving forward? Where did you get it?
You know, I probably got some of it from my parents. You know, they let us experiment and, you know, take things apart. And, you know, they didn't, I loved to understand, you know, electronics, and I would always take stuff apart.
You know, I know you said your dad would bring a calculator home, and that was amazing. What are the things that you were tinkering with?
Yeah, well, he had this, it's sort of like a pre-calculator. It was like an adding machine, you know, and you'd punch in the numbers. I'm like a little kid, you know, and I'm watching the numbers come out, and I'm like fascinated with this incredible machine. And then you saw the beginnings of the semiconductor revolution, you know, when I was just a couple of years old, right? And you're sort of watching, oh, you can do math problems with these things and incredibly complicated. You know, that was very exciting. And my parents, you know, didn't discourage us from those kinds of things. I think, you know, what I've seen is most people, unfortunately, only access a relatively small portion of what they're capable of. Hmm. Because they're afraid. They don't want to take risks. Don't want to make a mistake. And I think there's too much risk aversion generally in people wanting to go and do new things. So if you look at people that have accomplished a lot, I would bet you that they're taking more risks and are less afraid of failure than others. And, you know, I wasn't the smartest kid in my high school, right?
You weren't the dumbest kid in your high school either.
I did okay.
Were you involved in a lot of stuff, different activities?
I was interested in computers, and you know, I liked science, and you know, cars and that kind of stuff. So I was, you know, somewhat typical kid. Although computers were, I was sort of at the early end of that. But every paper I wrote in high school, I wrote on a computer. You know, at that time, that was sort of, you know, nobody knew what that was.
Sure, the early 80s. I mean, could you even print it out?
Yeah.
Dot matrix printers?
Yeah, we had dot matrix printers and daisy wheel printers if you wanted to make it look like a typewriter.
Yeah. Okay. So you were tinkering with things. Are you talking more cars here that you were taking apart and putting together? You said you were into that.
You know, I was in a seventh grade math class, and we had this thing called number sense. So I wasn't on a track team, wasn't on the football team, wasn't on the basketball team. I was in the number sense club.
Nice.
Okay, I'm talking real geeky, nerdy stuff here. So what we would do is we would calculate things in our head, you know, like multiply three numbers by three numbers, and you know, and we'd get, you know, compete with each other and go to contests and things like that. So this math teacher got a teletype terminal. Okay, so you write a program, send it off to the big computer in the sky. The answer would come back. So I was pretty fascinated by that. This was really before the personal computer showed up.
Yeah.
And then you started to see the microprocessor-based computers, and this was all around the time I was in, you know, junior high school, high school, and I was just fascinated by that stuff. So I just threw myself into that, learned everything I could, bought a personal computer, you know, ultimately tore it apart, you know, figured out how it worked. They were simple back then because you could actually learn how each chip functioned. And you could get a book, right? And it would tell you what actually happened inside the circuit, inside each, you know, chip. Mm-hmm. And you could build your own circuits and play around, upgrade them, make them go faster. And, you know, I was doing all that stuff. It was enormously fun and interesting.
Yeah, and that reminds me a lot of some of the programming capabilities that kids have now. I mean, even if you're looking at virtual reality, most people don't have the whole setup at home, but now kind of through the internet, you can send code off to places and do that. That's interesting. I hadn't seen that parallel before. Where did you learn management? At first, you start the company, it's mostly just you. Eventually, you've got people working for you, and you're young. How do you get up to speed?
Learn by making mistakes. I would actually call it leadership. I think a leader is somebody that other people want to follow. And so you have to think about, well, how do you motivate people? And how do you get them excited and engaged? And, you know, I hired some great people, hired some not so great people too, you know, but we asked them to leave, you know, fairly shortly thereafter. And we gradually built, you know, a great capability to be able to lead the organization forward. I would tell you that our initial success was more on the strength of the business model that we created, and less because we, you know, were leadership, you know, gurus or something, right? we were making all kinds of mistakes, but look, I was fortunate enough to hire some really great people, you know, a guy named Lee Walker that helped me very early on, another one named Mort Topfer, another one named Kevin Rollins, you know, all sorts of people at various times of the company. We had a fantastic board of directors, mm-hmm. you know, with people helping me. I, you know, went off to various courses to learn, read a bunch of books, all that kind of stuff. You learn by making mistakes and, you know, not making the same mistake over and over again.
Are there some books that jump out to you as being particularly influential for you?
Oh, you know, Ram Charan, you know, wrote a whole series of books. He still continues to write, you know, great, great management books. You know, Larry Bossidy wrote a number of great books about, you know, management and leadership. And so I studied and learned from the masters. And I remember one time I was in, I went to Stanford for a couple of weeks to take a course on leadership, right? And
how old were you at that time?
I tell you exactly, I was 24 years old.
Oh, okay, so this is early on.
And you know, the course was in the mornings, and the afternoons were sort of for homework and free time. And so I called up a bunch of the CEOs of Silicon Valley companies and said, "Hey, you know, can I come and see you? And I'd like to, you know, learn about what you're doing." And I don't know. Most of them said yes.
So this is like 1988, right?
Who are you calling? 1989.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who are you calling? I mean,
I was calling Irwin Fetterman and Jimmy Tribig and Andy Grove and Ken Oshman and a bunch of those guys, and they all said yes.
So Andy Grove had you in.
Yeah. And so, you know, you go see these guys, and, well, you know, how do you manage your a big company? And you know, they would talk to me, right? and so, you know, that was great. And I was doing everything I could to learn and, you know, get help, right? Because, look, our business in the first 8 years grew 80% per year. Mm. And for the 6 years after that, it grew 60% per year. So if you do the math with all that compounding, that's like, you know, tens of billions of dollars.
Sure.
And so, you know, we were quickly learning how to manage a much, much larger company. And it changed many, many times as it went from, you know, 100 people, 1,000, 10,000, 50,000.
When Steve Jobs was a younger guy, I don't remember whether it was Dave Packard or Bill Hewlett, he called up because he needed parts. You talk about coming to Silicon Valley to learn at Stanford and calling up CEOs and asking to come in and get that one-on-one coaching. Do young people do enough of that, making that bold ask? Because to a lot of people, that seems crazy. How am I going to call up Michael Dell and ask if I can come in and shadow him? I mean, granted, you had a company going that had some growth. You had some cred behind you already. But do people make that ask enough?
I certainly get lots of asks, so I'm not looking for any more, if that was your question.
It doesn't have to be you specifically, but I'm sure people have, you know, their local CEO. Are young people bold enough?
I'll go back to this theme I said earlier, which is I think actually people don't, they're less willing to take risks that they should in order to be successful.
My mother told me in high school, you get 50% of what you ask for at one point. Trying to shift my mindset on the number of swings I took. And I still remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, is that what you're saying? People need to get up to bat more?
I believe so. And I think, you know, too many people are not accessing anywhere near their potential because they don't want to make a mistake.
Huh. How does that factor in to the way you communicate with Dell employees today?
Well, we talk about risk in a good way, and we talk about experiments, and we have business plan competitions, and we have new ventures that we start inside the company, and we encourage those kinds of things because, you know, look, as companies get larger, risk can be like a dirty word. Oh, you know, risk committee, risk mitigation, you know. But, you know, risk and innovation absolutely go together. Hmm. And, you know, you're not going to have big innovations if you're not willing to take some risks.
In the way that you approach your job and what it takes to kind of get your juices flowing creatively. Are there things completely outside of work, hobbies, things that you do that give you a different perspective?
You know, I like to, you know, read a lot, and obviously the internet is amazing in terms of being able to have access to the world's information mm-hmm. in real time, you know, in enormous quantities. So, you know, I'm naturally pretty curious and love to learn, and so it's sort of a, you know, it never been a better time to be curious, because you can learn an incredible, you know, amount, and to me that's just endlessly exciting. It's also important to get enough sleep too. So you know, you can do too much of that. So, you know, I work hard to have what I think is a good balance in my life in terms of time with my family, obviously love what I do, time to exercise and sleep. You know, and if you're going to do something for a long time, you better have a system to do it that is going to last.
Right. So do you unplug, or are you one of those people like me who, even on vacation, you kind of got your phone with you? You're not looking at it all the time, but you want to sort of manage.
I have been with separation anxiety, right? And so if I'm not connected, I just don't feel good, right? So I like to stay connected, but you know, it's important to relax and have time to reflect and think, for sure.
You mentioned Kevin Rollins. There was a time when you handed over the CEO role to him, to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you would do again?
Ask me in 5 or 10 years.
But it's not something you'd be contemplating today, it sounds like.
Plans to do that, no.
What did you learn from that experience?
Well, you know, it didn't work out as everyone had planned, and the board asked me to come back into the CEO role, and so I did. And I was actively involved in the company during the whole time.
Sure, so your offices were right next to each other.
That's right. Anything that happened there that wasn't, you know, wasn't supposed to happen, you know, I take a big portion of the blame or credit for it. So what's the
difference? What's the difference in having the founder CEO?
Well, I think founders have a bit of special permission to make changes at their companies, and maybe we're a pretty good test case for that, because we keep changing things and evolving from where we started. And you know, look, I'll care about this company after I'm dead. So, you know, it's just a different perspective in terms of time, and I've been doing this for 33 years and still pretty young, got a lot of energy and long way to go.
That's pretty unique. I don't know how much you think about this, but you know, Larry Ellison stepped to the executive chairman role from this era of technology that continues to stretch, kind of the personal computing revolution into web, into mobile, into whatever we're moving into now. There are only so many founder CEOs left.
Yeah, well, I started when I was 12. So, you know, not exactly.
But, 19, but okay. Yeah. Close to 12.
I started messing around with computers when I was 12.
Sure.
But look, it's fun. It's interesting. I'd be bored if I wasn't doing this.
But what does it mean to you to be still doing it? I mean, you started early, you're still, you know, you're back in the CEO role, the company's got your name on it. I'm trying to think, you know, Larry's still active at Oracle. Bill Gates has taken a step back from Microsoft. You talk about Andy Grove, you know, he passed on, and many people have things to say about that, his incredible legacy. What does it mean to you at this point to still be in the game leading this company that you started?
Couldn't imagine any other way. So, it is the most interesting and exciting time in our industry. When I step back and think about the explosion in the number of connected devices, the new computer science, you know, the fifth generation settler network, everything that's going on in our world, you know, this would be like absolutely the wrong time to not be in the center of things.
Is there one technology or challenge or possibility that you see coming down the pike that you think is being undercovered, people aren't thinking about enough?
You know, I think it's difficult to answer that question. You know, I would not be surprised if there are some very significant breakthroughs in health as it relates to genomic data. Mm. And, you know, that's incredibly interesting, especially when you think about epigenetic expression and how computational resources can be used to unlock some of the mysteries there. So, you know, in the health area, you know, the intersection between the information sciences and the biosciences, you know, that's a very, very interesting area. I think just the sheer amount of data across all industries, there will be big breakthroughs. And usually they're not so much technological as they are business model innovations on top of the new capabilities that are brought with all the things that we're talking about. So it's hard to predict the combinatorial inventions that are created in terms of business model, downstream. And, you know, we know that they'll be there. We don't know exactly what they will be. And to some extent, we don't even care, right? It's all good.
I want to talk a little bit about your philanthropy. You and your wife have a foundation. One of the areas where you focused is on urban youth, an opportunity. Tell me, are there things that you see happening there, areas where people can make a difference that have had an impact on you?
Yeah, I think there's sort of a new model of philanthropy emerging and sort of outgrew from the results orientation and focus on return on investment and outcomes and data and results and success that, you know, you would find in a company like ours. And we've applied that to our philanthropic work and had some pretty remarkable successes.
For example?
Education is one good one. So we started working in a number of the schools, some of the more troubled schools, and we found that they didn't really have any data, right? And they weren't measuring things. And when they started measuring, there was no normative standard across measuring things so that you could actually benchmark them. And so imagine, you know, running a massive organization with no data whatsoever. Mm. And so we created something called EdFi, which is now open source. It's public domain. I think we've got about 35 of the 50 states using it now. And it's a way to measure outcomes and success, you know, at the school level, at the student level, you know, at the teacher level, that's opened up all sorts of possibilities in terms of how do you actually advance outcomes and success inside these sometimes, you know, pretty challenged schools.
It sounds like you're feeling pretty optimistic about where the company, where the industry is headed.
Yes, I am.
What gives you that sense? Because I know a number of people in Silicon Valley, yes, the stocks are doing well. Yes, there are still a lot of big ideas coming out, but it seems like mood-wise, people aren't so sure.
Well, I'm excited because I see our customers excited by what we're doing, and they're responding in, you know, kind of business coming our way. So it's pretty easy to see that things are working from that perspective. But when I step back more broadly and go and meet with some of these customers, you know, I met with a customer a few weeks ago in Europe, and they're creating about 1 billion new IP addresses every year.
Internet of Things?
it's not a computer company, right? right? They're making it's the Internet of Things, and they're using Pivotal as the operating system to be able to do that. And that's just one example. You look across all of the various sectors, the cost of making something intelligent is approaching $0. And so the number of intelligent things is just exploding. And so then you layer on top of that this new computer science, and you have sort of this Cambrian explosion of opportunity, the fourth industrial revolution.
And America
and so we are super excited about that.
Is America well positioned?
If you're not excited about that, you're dead or you're asleep.
is America well positioned in that writ large?
I think it is. I think it's a time for software, right? It's a time for networks and semiconductors and technology. And yeah, software is eating the world, but software doesn't run on software.
That's right.
Right? Software runs on.
Somebody's got to make the hardware.
Somebody's got to make all this stuff.
Yeah.
That would be us, right? So we're providing all the infrastructure for all these things that are happening, and we're seeing it. I mean, the Internet of Things was sort of like an idea a few years ago. Now it's actually happening, and we called it embedded intelligence and smart devices and things like that, earlier on, and now we're actually seeing it in scale.
Well, on that optimistic note, I got to say thanks for sitting down with CNBC, with Fort Knox. It's been a great conversation. Thank you, Michael Dell.
Sure thing.
My thanks to Michael Dell. I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Please do leave a review if you enjoyed this. Also, check out Fort Knox Live on Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, and YouTube. I'm taking your comments and questions, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. I tackle some of the most interesting business and economic issues there with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Next week on the podcast, Kirill Tartarinov is the CEO of Citrix Systems. Born in the communist USSR, his family escaped oppression and then war as he built the skills he would need to rise through the technology world. Go ahead and subscribe to Fort Knox now on your iPhone's podcast app or on Google Play. Meanwhile, share this. Tell a friend. Drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or fortknox.com. That's FORTTKNOX.com. And as always, thank you for lending an ear.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.